Welcome back to the Veterans Advocate Podcast. My guest today is Ron Parsons. He spent several years on Johnson Island. If you recall the last interview I did, there was a man named Frank who also spent a couple years on Johnson Island, but these guys were there at least 30 years apart. Frank was there in the 60s, Ron was there in the 90s, and both of them tell a very similar story. So Johnson Island, just to recap very quickly, is an island where at least three accidental nuclear explosions occurred, contaminating the entire island and the surrounding area. The government did a shoddy job of cleaning up the mess and just pushed all the sand into the harbor, where many guys went scuba diving and swimming every day after work. And on top of that, if that wasn't bad enough, they stored millions of gallons of Agent Orange there from the post-Vietnam era all the way through the early 2000s. There was a building on there called JCADS, which existed for the sole purpose of incinerating chemical, nuclear, and biological weapons. So everybody on that island, in some capacity, was involved in the handling, storage, moving, and the eliminating of all these chemical, nuclear, and biological weapons. So everybody there has a different story. Some people had the time of their life because it is a tropical paradise, minus the nuclear fallout and the Agent Orange leaking on the beach. But it has a greater than average rate of cancer for veterans. And unfortunately, the VA does not recognize any connection between service on Johnson Island and higher than average diagnosis of cancer, especially like thyroid cancer, sinus cancer, some of those kind of things. So there's a lot of patterns emerging from the stories that we're talking to. And I want to get the word out about this because I think it's important that we take care of our veterans. And one of the ways we do that is by getting stories out in the open for everyone to see. So this will also be on YouTube. If you want to check that out, you can go to my YouTube channel and check out the Veterans Advocate Podcast there. And you can search for Johnson Island and it'll pop up. You can search for Atomic Veterans and it'll pop up. And I think it's important. So share away. I want to spread awareness for this issue because these guys deserve to have everything available to them to help them treat their cancers. So many of their friends have already died and they're all kind of worried that they're going to lose more friends, you know, and they themselves have cancer as well. And that's unfortunate. And we need to do a better job about taking care of our veterans. And I need your help to do it. So share away and tell everybody you know. It's an interesting topic. And if we do that, we can take care of our own. Thanks for listening.
Got there something now.
Yeah, I see the blue light popped on there. Right. I didn't know how to activate that. I thought it was automatic. So.
Yep. All right. Yeah, I'm going to go ahead and start recording if that's okay with you.
That's fine. Yeah.
Okay. Awesome. Thank you, Ron, for joining me today.
Sure. Thank you.
Yeah. So I know that you have some experience with Johnson Island, and I've been trying to collect some people who have been on the island and can kind of tell in their own words their experiences. I think you're familiar with the episode I did on the history of Johnson Island as far as the nuclear tests and the storage of the Agent Orange and the various other things. So I wanted to hear, just kind of start to finish, your experience with the island.
Okay. Well, I arrived in 1990 from Fort Jackson. I was a clerk and I was sent there to work, you know, for 12 months, but I extended my tour for a second year. So I ended up staying there 2 years. So I worked in security plans and operations. They called it SPO 3. It was in the JCADS building, which is a big yellow building on the island. And I didn't really learn a lot of the history and that I know now until I left. I knew that there were, you know, chemical weapons stored over there. And then when we got to the island, we'd seen where there was a, you know, fenced off area for the Agent Orange. Did not know anything about the Thor missiles until a couple years ago when I got cancer and I started researching a little bit more. And I believe I emailed you a document that was on a few minutes ago that was on the internet that I can't find anymore for some reason. I'm not saying I took it off purposely. It's just I, you know, probably am not trying to locate it like I did the first time. But, you know, there's some information in there where they were talking about the Thor missiles in 62. And they had two misfires where they had explosions and dumped radiation and plutonium on it. And of course, you know, island life, there was not a lot to do there. You go snorkeling, fishing, diving quite a bit. And a lot of those contaminants were in the lagoon that we did not know about. You know, it was just, you know, not really alerted. People were more concerned about the chemical weapons, you know, the sarin and the ex-agent that we were actually disarming over there, which I didn't actually work in the Red Hat area. So I went down there, you know, a few times for tours and, you know, just learning about it. So mainly the 54 Bravos were working in that area. they had some interesting things that happened on the island. You know, a lot of dignitaries come out, the King of Samoa, Senator Inouye, and just kind of, you know, seeing and kind of giving their blessing for what they were doing on the island to get rid of the chemical munitions. The King of Samoa, he had a beard for like 20 years that was kind of traditional. And I think they said that he had to shave it before he came out to the island so he could get a seal on a mask in case there was a leaker. The guys that were working in the Red Hat area, when I would go down there, it always seemed like they were always trying to contain a leaker in one of those bunkers. So they would, you know, be wrapped up in their butyl rubber suits, and they would go in there and have to seal those up. And when they got done and decontaminated, they'd have that much sweat in their boots, you know, and it's really hot in those things. And now I didn't have to do that, like I said, but I got to go down there and see those guys that were doing it. But so I was actually, you know, right there in front of a bunker without a mask, even though it had a leaker on it. And their platoon sergeant was, or E7 or higher, was instructing them what to do when they go in there. And they didn't have mask on in front of the bunker, so I don't know what the distance radius they were required to have that on. But I know that I don't think I'd want to be standing in front of those bunkers knowing that there was a leaker in there. So I was a little nervous about that. But it was high stress, you know, job. It was a 6-day work week for most of us, sometimes 7. But so when stress time came, they had a lot of activities for you to do. You could go snorkeling, diving, windsurfing, fishing, deep sea fishing. You could swim in the pools. They had DOD shows. But a lot of my time I would spend out in the water. And unfortunately, I didn't realize that when it would rain, it would wash contaminants into the ocean from where the AO spill was. I think there was about 350,000 gallons that leaked in 1976.
Yeah, and I think that's pretty close, yeah.
And the way I understand it, when I was reading through those documents, that it was in the water table as well. So I'm not, the way I understand it anyway, combined with that, everybody that would go into the ocean and swim, and that's washed out into the ocean as well, contaminating it. And when they had the Thor missiles explode, they pushed those contaminants into the lagoon as well. And nobody warned anyone, you know, you just go swimming in. It was just a normal day. Oh, you're safe, it's fine. But if you look at, like, you know, the things that are out in the past few years, like the movie Chernobyl, yes, when you're there with those incidents, they have very catastrophic, you know, events that happen and casualties that occur from those events are pretty high and pretty strong. But you learn that, you know, I guess back in science class, when you're in the, of course, I was in high school in the 80s, you know, radiation has about a 50-year life, and then plutonium, I think, is a 24,000-year half-life. Yep. And I was reading where plutonium is not toxic to touch, but when it gets in the air and dust particles, then it becomes toxic. And Johnson Island always had a 15-knot wind which is about 25 to 28 miles per hour. And the reason they chose that site for the chemical demilitarization is so if anything escaped to the stacks, it would dissipate in the wind. But when you've got 24 acres of radiation and plutonium, and I don't know how that was sealed or anything, whatever, in a bunker or whatever, but I don't think you can contain all those contaminants. So when you're, that's blowing and it's in your lungs, nose, whatever. And I kind of took a little more interest when I found out I had nasal pharyngeal cancer. So I got into a little bit more of the history. They had, I think, about 200,000 munitions come over from Germany, which was, it's been, you know, articles online I found where they had talked about that, not in detail, but I know they took a naval ship out of dry dock. They took it and loaded it up in Germany, and they couldn't come through Guadalcanal because of all the old munitions. They didn't want to let them take that shortcut, so they had to go around South America and come back up, and they hit some storms. They're hitting 25, 30-foot waves or whatever. And when they get to the island, you know, they're just constantly containing leakers as they go around. So everybody was carrying masks around for that time period. And but still no worries, not really a big alert, and everything seemed to go fine, as far as we know, until I start joining this website, or not really a website, but a page on Facebook for Johnson Atoll Health Issues, and I see all these people with different issues, and you don't know what they're caused from or whatever. I had a chance to go to Imbanica, and I turned it down, and another one of my friends there, Stephen Turner, who was also a clerk, he went on the trip as the clerk, and they flew him down there into a field, and they were getting munitions from World War II to bring back, which Imbanica is Solomon Islands, and it's down by Guadalcanal. So I guess in World War II, when it's time to go home, they just shut everything off the ship and get as many people on board as they can and bring them back home is pretty much the scenario from where they're Japan, leaving vehicles behind or whatever. And even in the Vietnam era, they did the same thing with helicopters, just push them over boats. You know, the more you can get on, the better, but just get rid of the weight and bring troops on. And one of the interesting things out there that happened was Greenpeace came out and they were wanting to storm the island. Of course, they didn't, you know, but it was kind of a big deal for that time. And I think Lieutenant General Kicklider was the Pacific commander at the time, and David R. Moss was the base colonel for the Army. And I think Colonel Brent Smith was the Air Force commander at the time there. So, and I think after that it was Colonel Doesburg was after that, which he retired as a major general. And then I can't remember who was after Brent Smith on the Air Force side for the Air Force. Had a Russian nuclear sub come out to check on what we were doing. They broke down. They dry docked them, and until they could get parts out to them, they weren't allowed out. We always had Micronesia flights coming in to refuel. They weren't allowed off the planes or anything because they were civilians. They didn't have masks, so they had to stay on board, refuel, take off. They had a heavy downpour one day. It blew an engine out, so they had to shut down operations for like a week or two, and the civilians were walking around the island and everything like that. And I'm like, oh, it's no big deal, you know, whatever, but you just don't know what, you know, may have happened to those people that were there as well. So,
yeah.
But they always had plenty of things to do. You know, just the main issue with a lot of people and the military is when you're landlocked like that, there's a lot of drinking going on and different things. And people can get into trouble for, you know, certain things, letting that stress off because they lose their mind out there from being so landlocked. I mean, you're stuck there for 12 months and it's 2 miles long, probably a quarter mile wide. The I guess some people got out there faster than others, but not too many. A lot of people dealt with it pretty well. And a lot of it was, if you like the ocean life, you know, there was, you know, plenty of things to do. And I was looking at where they had the first initial Thor missile, I guess, accident. It was on Sand Island. Well, you can take a boat over there and walk around the island as long as you didn't walk on the frigate birds, because they had a, I think it was a blue-footed booby, and the frigate birds would nest over there, and mainly the frigates, but you could walk around the island. You weren't allowed to walk. So could have been walking through contaminants or whatever, who knows. It was out there by Loran Tower on one of those islands. Those are little three little smaller islands out there. But I probably went snorkeling in the, or swimming in that ocean in the lagoon there probably, you know, 3 to 5 times a week. You know, I mean, it was beautiful coral down there, and that you could, you know, go down and see, you know, sea life and everything. And you could go out to the edge of the reef, and you could, you know, get underwater and look just outside that edge of that reef. And it was 1200 fathoms, which is 7,200 feet. And you can see ocean life swimming around. I mean, it was pretty miraculous, but take your mind off of the stress of being out there. So it was unique.
Yeah. So that sounds really, if it weren't for, you know, all the hazardous waste stuff floating around, that sounds like paradise, really.
I mean, it does.
If you minus all of the bad stuff.
Oh yeah. I would give anything to live in, you know, like Grand Cayman, where you have really beautiful clear water, or even, you know, in Hawaii. I mean, Hawaii, the waters are a little more, I guess, got a lot more force and strength to them than they do in the Caribbean. But yeah, it's your ocean life. Once you get to live it for a while and you're pulled away from it, you're like kind of drawn back to it. You know, now I'm stuck in the Midwest here. So it's not as nice. I think people are drawn to water, really. I've read studies where people tend to have a happier attitude. It's like having a dog, you know, it just kind of lengthens your life, but unless there's chemicals there. So that's the other issue. So
yeah, the lagoon is unfortunately, from what I've read, the focal point of all of the hazardous debris. From what I've read, all of the nuclear disasters that they had, every time a rocket would fail, they would just scoop up all the parts and push it right into the lagoon.
Yes.
Yeah. I don't know enough about the science of it, of the lagoon, you know, to say for sure. I got to think that it dissipates a little bit and gets carried off, maybe, hopefully, but you know, if
over
something,
time.
Yeah. But if you have a, you know, something like a warhead or like a rocket engine that still has fuel in it, you know, that's just going to sit there and continue to contaminate an area for a very long time.
Right. Now, when I snorkeled around, I didn't see anything like that. And I can't remember which end of the island was north or south. But out where the JOC was, I do remember some Navy SEALs coming out, and they dove down and they detonated some munitions that were dumped off down there. And we got to watch that, because you can, you know, watch the blast come up from the water. And it was very brief, but I mean, that's just what they found. So like, say here's the island, and over here's Sand Island, and another island, the munitions were over here. So I don't know if they just exploded out there, or if it's something that was down there they want to get rid of, or if it was an actual munition that was dumped from World War II or what. That was never really, you know, privy to me, even though I got to work with a lot of the different documents that my office gave to me to type up. It was more procedural for military police and the 54 Bravos that they had to follow when they were down in that area, and maybe some security events, but some of that may have been above my level. I wasn't allowed to work with, but I only had a secret clearance at the time, and I think the A7s and above had a top secret. So there's a lot of things that I didn't, you know, really get to know about, but a lot of stuff I'm talking about has all been declassified. I'm looking at it on the internet, so I know it's, you know, it's out there. So I'm not, you know, exposing anything that people don't know already.
Absolutely.
But I did see where another guy on the Johnson Atoll webpage passed away a week ago from glioblastoma. And now I don't know if that guy was on the Johnson Atoll health issues page or not. But I know there's over 500 people on there, and I don't know how many are medical, but a lot of them do have medical issues. And I don't know if they'll ever do anything with it, because the broad spectrum that's going to cover. I mean, when you talk about the radiation, the plutonium, the Agent Orange that was brought there from, Okinawa. So they have issues in Okinawa. So when you get into dealing with the government, military compensation, I guess, to cover your medical issues or whatever, or even if they do, you know, like a disability claim or anything like that, you're looking at opening a can of worms to so many areas that were exposed as Taiwan, you know, Vietnam. If you go back to Germany, where munitions that we got came from over there. So when you pay, if you have to pay people over there, it's not in American dollars you have to pay. You have to, you know, change that to German dollars, which would be exponentially more, for them. One of my friends that I joined with, he retired just recently as a lieutenant colonel, and he was in for 30 years, and he was explaining that to me, how when they pay them off, if that was to open up that area for them, because they had the BX agents and the sarin gas over there stored, like 200,000 rounds.
Yeah.
It gets to be so broad and so expensive. But the only thing that really ticked me off, and I really shouldn't be ticked off about it, but like 9/11, that was very, you know, horrible event that happened. And they put, like, they just authorized, what was it? Was it 32 or 42 billion this year?
Yeah, it was quite a bit of money.
Yeah. But yet they still deny anyone that was stationed around all these contaminants that was doing, you know, a service to the country to get rid of it. And, it's just kind of disheartening that, if you're, a member of service, you're kind of less than value to, you know, civilian value. So it kind of ticks me off a little bit, but that's just
me. It should, man. And I agree. Yeah. Not to say that 9/11 guys don't deserve that money. It's just that everybody does, you know.
Right.
It's not just one. It's everybody does, you know. And I've talked to many people who've come down with cancer. I just talked to another gentleman earlier today. His name was Frank. I think you know Frank from the group. I don't know how to pronounce his last name. It's Frank.
Yeah, I go through it.
Yeah.
It's there's quite a bit in there, and there's actually more and more people. I just added a guy to the group the other day that was a bus driver there. So, but now he's not a enlisted member or the military or anything like that, but he was there working for several years, and he drove the bus on Saturdays when from people were going over to the plant, and so he's made a lot of trips around that island on the bus, you know. And you get downwind of that stuff, you're susceptible, and you get upwind of it, you're a little more safe, but still you're there. And there's a lot of people that don't really know about that side as well. I mean, we probably have a lot more people. I was trying to reach out to a guy named Robert Lemon, and we called him Bob Lemon when I was out there, and he was one who was actually containing a leaker when I was in the Red Hat area. We were there at the same time, and ironically, he just lives 3 or 4 hours north of me here, and I found him on the internet, but I can't seem to contact him on Facebook, so I don't know if he's alive or dead. I saw a photo with him where he had a bandage around his head on Facebook, and like a big lump up here or something like that covered up by the bandage. But I don't know if that's an injury from work or if that's, you know, something, you know, from there, because I wanted to alert him to the group. But the only person I think that has ever gotten compensation for any type of chemical out or issue, not even really any chemical compensation from being out there, was a guy who, PTSD from, he was scared he was always going to be contaminated by the munitions in there. So he just kind of freaked out and he got PTSD for that. And I can imagine that'd be pretty stressful. You know, it's a real thing. You know, it's not just combat issues, you know, it's actual putting your life on the line, and you're like, you haven't really thought about it until it actually happens. And then, you know, it creates that inner stress. But I had looked up on mine. I was thinking, how did I get this? Because I was tested by my doctor on just about everything that causes this particular form of cancer. And they couldn't come up with anything. And so I just happened to be sitting out in the lobby waiting to see Dr. David Kim. And I brought that magazine back and I showed it to him. I think it was Fort Rucker, Alabama, on how all these civilians were sick and dying down from Monsanto's Agent Orange from the base. And I said, let me tell you where I was stationed. I started showing it to him and he goes, I'm going to write you a presumptive letter. I guess, I don't know if it's going to go anywhere, but we have not found anything to link you, your cancer to this. And he goes, and it doesn't develop overnight. It takes time for it to just, once it's in your body, it's just waiting to come out. So, so thankfully for me, I was cured. I'm a little over 2 years out now. I kind of went through that, and they don't, it's not really a valid case for the radiation or plutonium. So unless you were there during the actual incident of the missile. So you can breathe in all these toxins and swim in it and whatever, but if you weren't there for the incident, too bad. So that's just the way it is. And it's the same thing for the Agent Orange. After 1976, there was a lady in Henderson I ran into who graduated with, I can't remember her name, but she graduated with a degree in, trying to think what she said it was. They basically go out and, you know, become a reporter and.
Oh yeah, like journalism and stuff.
Journalism, yes. I think this is chemo brain, not old age. It's actually a thing that exists. It's I was looking it up and talking to my doctor about it. You have chemotherapy. It's kind of like you almost have Alzheimer's. You get the cloudy mind and you can't think of certain terms sometimes, and it happens a lot lately. It lasts for about 5 years post chemotherapy. So,
no, I didn't know that.
And I was on cisplatin. So, that was actually developed in like the 1800s, and they found out in the 50s that it worked well for certain cancers. So they started using that. But she was saying her dad worked for the VA over in Louisville and was told, you deny everyone after 1976. You know, if they weren't in the Vietnam era, deny them. So.
Huh. I believe it.
Yeah. So it's you know, a certain issue. And ironically, she was a girl who had cancer as well. And she had some type of esophageal, and it was pretty traumatic, no stomach and everything. She had it like when she was 19, and went through like 6 years of just continually going through that. So, but unrelated to, you know, Johnson. So yep. Completely, but it was just ironic that I ran into her and we started talking about, you know, cancer, because she was looking at me and she was like, you gained weight. I'm like, oh yeah, okay. Because I'd lost 60 pounds and I, you know, explaining to her about the cancer, and she was saying about her, and I was telling her I was trying to do the claim, and she said, well, good luck on that, because I don't think you're going to get it, because my dad was told, you know, what I previously stated. So. Was an issue there. So,
yeah.
But you know, you have people like, I had a buddy, Scott Pitts, who I'm pretty sure he retired as well, because I saw him on Facebook a couple years ago, and he was at the Pentagon, had gotten out and went back in, but he was constantly trapping, you know, fish, crabs and stuff, and, you know, to put in the tank he had in his, you know, room and eat as well, you know, and we all caught fish and ate fish. So fish were all contaminated, you know. It's just that the exponential issues that you do out there just seem to escalate, and there was no warning, you know. Just we were told there was three of us went out there: Steve Johnson, Stephen Turner, and myself, and from Fort Jackson. And we were called in. They said, we need three people to go to Johnson Island. And they explained it to us, and well, not sure we want to go to a chemical area. Oh no, it's perfectly safe. You know, we're young and naive. Okay, well, yeah, it's safe. Why not? You know, maybe it'll, you know, give us some exposure for learning something new, and, you know, potential, you know, way to get rank if you're in a hardship or something like that, you know, and you can get some school time in while you're out there, you get promotion points. And they had a little a retired colonel that was teaching college classes out there, so you could get, you know, credits while you're, you know, working out there. So it was just it might sound like a no-brainer, you know. So, but little did I know. So.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's a crazy story, and you led me on to a tip that I kind of went down the rabbit hole a little bit when you mentioned the World War II tanker leaving Germany and being basically sunk, or and dumping the munitions off Solomon Island. I started reading up on that, and I found, oh man, I don't even know how many instances. I would say that it's safe to say, rough estimate, there's probably 1 million tons of dumped chemical, biological, and nerve agents all around the world. And surprisingly, a ton off the East Coast of the United States. And it's all open record. And there's this one gentleman who got through the Freedom of Information Act and stuff like that and built a database, and you can Google it. And he has a Google Earth file you can download, and it'll show you exactly where all of the dump sites are. And wow. Yeah, it's a lot of mustard gas. It's a lot of mustard gas. Yeah. So that was manufactured all throughout World War I and all throughout World War II by the Germans.
Right.
And when the war was over, that stuff was stockpiled by the Russians and the United States. You know, we kind of essentially agreed that we weren't going to use it, but you know how it goes.
Right.
What good is that agreement once the mustard gas starts flying? And when the World War II was over, we took a lot of that stuff out of there and shipped it other places. And after the wall fell down, then we got rid of all of it.
Right.
And that was when we really started cleaning things up, you know, right around, you know, 1990-91 timeframe.
Yeah, that was a lot to do with Ronald Reagan, the chemical disarmament agreement. And ironically, my friend I was telling you about, I joined with, who went to West Point after a couple years in, he had learned Czech, the language, out of Presidio Monterey before he went to, or got the chance to go to West Point. And he was an intel officer for the first 3 years, and he actually got to go to Russia to basically inspect their disarmament of munitions there, kind of like what we were doing out where we were. So he was on one spectrum, I was on the other. So, but he did that for 3 years before he went into special forces. And we're going to have dinner tomorrow night. We're going to talk about, you know, things from the past. I haven't seen him for a long time because in special ops, he was not allowed to have a Facebook page or anything like that, limited on emails. It's gone 6 months out of the year at a time. So it's a different life, you know. I can't imagine doing that for, let's see, he graduated 96 from West Point. So 96 till recently, you know, or actually 99 was the time he became a Special Forces officer. So all that time out on the, in the field going wherever. But, you know, I guess it's great TDY pay because you don't pay taxes, so, or federal taxes anyway, so you got to save a lot of money.
No, absolutely.
Yeah. Well,
so that's a really incredible story, and I'm going to do another episode solely devoted to the mustard gas thing, because that in and of itself is just, that's a wild story to think about what we did and how we did it and why we did it. And that there's just hundreds and hundreds of thousands of tons of mustard gas at the bottom of the ocean, and sometimes not that far away. So that, I think, warrants its own story.
Right. It definitely does. Now, here's something I don't know if you knew or not, but I asked one time, and I don't know if they were pulling my leg, and I haven't found the information yet. But when they were hydrolyzing the munitions out there where I was, and I said, what do you mean by hydrolyzing? So they would inject water to dilute. Then they'd run through, heat it up for 1,000 degrees, and then let it crystallize, cut it up in 7 pieces, and then they buried 1,000 feet deep somewhere in California.
Really?
So, yeah, that's what it was explained to me. So I don't know if that's true or not, because I'm thinking, you know, anybody digging in California with as many fault lines as they have, that seems kind of bizarre to me. I would think they would do something else, but I really don't know. So I
was that Johnson Island Chemicals, or was that a different area?
Johnson Island, yeah. Because I'm not much on my science or anything like that. But I was thinking, you burn something at 1,000 degrees, it's going to disintegrate, you know, is what I was thinking. So why would, you know, so I don't know if they have, like, you know, coal plants have that potash or whatever it is that they burn afterwards. You know, you see mountains and mountains of it pile up, and they just, you know, plant grass seed over it, just like anything else, put dirt and grass seed over it. But I don't know if maybe that's what they did with that stuff, if there was residual or whatever that they would bury, but they said it would crystallize. I'm like, what? So I never got to see the process or anything like that, but it would be interesting to know for sure if that's what they did with it. So,
yeah, I'm trying to find somebody who knows a little bit more about that. And so far I haven't had anybody, but if you know of anybody who has some inside knowledge, I'd be more than happy to talk to them as well.
I looked, and he's still alive. He's a retired Major General. I have not connected with him or anything, but it's John C. Doesburg. And I'm trying to think, let me look on my phone to see where he lives. I don't know how you would come into contact with him. I did see that Colonel David Moss died a couple years ago, or a year or two ago, and he was out in Colorado, and I know he was very intelligent. I think it was chemistry and biology, and let's see, I think he went and had a doctorate or something at one point. Let's see, Colonel John, but these guys are getting up in age. And let's see, I know he was interviewed recently. I'm trying to look it up. Yeah, he just wrote a letter in 2019. Let's see, to the University of North Texas. Letter from John C. Doesburg from the Oak Ridge National Laboratory in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. So he's still out there. He just wrote a letter on November 20th of this year.
Okay. Yeah, I'll have to try to find that.
But he was the base commander, and he would know absolutely everything. You know, not the base commander. He was the Army commander. They had another colonel that was the base commander for the Air Force. Because it was Air Force controlled. We were just out there for the chemical part of it. So.
Oh, okay.
And it was basically joint readiness, almost like that.
Yeah. Whatever.
But he's still alive, and he would be the one who would have the most knowledge. I know there's a captain that was out there. His name is Scott Koenig, K-O-E-N-I-G. I actually saw him at Fort Campbell, Kentucky, when I went there after Johnson Island. And there's a Mark Solheid, he's an E7, S-O-L-H-E-I-D, but he was a sergeant first class out there. He retired after there. But I'd seen where he might have been working for NASA or something like that. I don't know what he was doing, unless it's just a joke, what I'd seen on his profile. But I haven't found a way to contact him or anything. But so I'm going around and doing this. But if there's anyone in here that is an officer that was in the chemical corps, those would be the ones that you would want to talk to. Now, I'm trying to think this there was a guy that was out there with me. He was the last captain in the office I work with, security plans and operations. And I think his name was Chris something, but he was a major up in Newport, Indiana, which is just north of me, a few hours. And they had 3% of the stockpile up there. And he was commander of that facility till they closed it up. What is his name? He's coming to me. Isaacson is his name. Chris Isaacson. And he was a major at Newport Chemical. And he would be probably pretty knowledgeable as well. But John C. Dozberg would be the one I would really love to talk to about those issues. And in particular, to ask him why he hasn't petitioned Congress for the soldiers that were there. So, I mean, if that's your boys, then you ought to, and you're, in the authority to know, I don't think it'll hurt him any. I mean, he's getting a pretty nice pension, so.
Yeah,
exactly. Lieutenant General Kicklider said something to him one time when he was there. I was driving Kicklider around for his stay on the island and talk to him about certain things. And I heard Kicklider tell him, he goes, "Oh, don't worry about them one stars, John." He goes, "They're a dime a dozen." He goes, "When you get two and three, then I'll talk, and then we'll worry." So he actually made it to that two star. So that's kind of ironic too, but. Because it's really difficult to get past that colonel level, and he did it. So, but he would be a guy that would have all the nose and insides, what they did with everything. It's just be kind of interesting to pick his ear, see what's inside that head of his,
Yeah, absolutely. I'll try to get a hold of him. Well, I want to thank you for meeting with me, but before we go, I like to end the show and always just ask a couple questions. One of the questions is, so what was it like for you when you got out of the military? Like when you were transitioning from the military into the civilian world, how well did that go for you? What was that like?
Well, considering I was getting married, like less than 3 weeks after I got out, it was quite exciting, really. I had thought about staying in, but my wife was like, "I'm not sure I want you to." And to me, the thought of, making a career out of it and retiring early, would be something fun to do. And I don't look back and say, "Oh, I wish I could have, wish I had done that anyway," or anything. But it's different. I like the military for some things. I like some of the structure. I was happy to get away from the abuse of power, because you do see that a lot more than you do in the civilian world, because you don't have to take it. There you have to take it, whether you liked it or not. Now it's a little different nowadays because Colin was telling me that they got these stress cards, timeout cards, and stuff like that when they're in basic training. I'm like, what? it was kind of exciting for me because I was going to school too. I was going out to USI and University of Southern Indiana. I did not finish. I wish I had. But my wife and I were going at the same time, and it just got too expensive after about 3 years into it. So one of us had to, really concentrate on keeping a full-time job. And so when she got done, then I was thinking about going back, and I just kind of let it go and didn't do it. But there were some things I wish I had done while I was in. I got to do the air assault course at Fort Campbell, which was fun. I would have probably never ever jumped out of a plane, but knowing that Colin got to do the certain things that he did, being in special ops, they get to do the halo jumps, and he goes, "Oh, that don't even bother you." I think, man, I should have done that. So that's, it would have been kind of fun to be in special forces or something like that, I think, where you get to, really just go out and, see the world and do tactical things and just, experience the things you see in these movies nowadays that seem surreal, like the 5th Special Forces Group out of Fort Campbell when they went over to Afghanistan, and they had like even like 3 years to establish a relationship with the I guess it was the Afghans. I can't remember the.
Yeah. So funny story. I met that man.
Really cool.
Yeah. So there's a book. It's called Horse Soldiers.
Horse Soldiers. Okay.
Yep. And it follows the 5th Special Forces Group, the Green Berets. And in the book, there is a man who is a captain who's leading that entire thing. And there's a movie that's made, and it's called 12 Strong.
Yes, I saw that.
Okay. Yeah. That movie is terrible, but the book is fantastic. Yes. And I met the man that book is about. And the Captain Mitchum, I think is his name in the book.
Yes.
That's a pseudonym. That's not his real name. It's declassified now, but he owns a whiskey business in Florida, and it's called Horse Soldier Whiskey.
Horse Soldier Whiskey. Okay.
Yep. So if you want to drink some top end whiskey, that's what he does now. He's retired. He does motivational speeches, and he makes whiskey.
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't drink, but I used to, but now I might have a beer once or twice a year. With nasopharyngeal cancer, it's really, you'd have to become an alcoholic to do that, but it can bring that type of cancer back.
Why risk it?
Yeah. And so since I'm not and never have been, you know, a big drinker, except when I was out of Johnson Island, you know, everybody did that. But when I left there, I kind of left that drinking thing in the past. And then it's fun to hang out and have a drink or two with people, you know, but other than that, I don't really keep anything in the home. But it's it is interesting, a lot of these guys, the things that they do, and you know, how they can set their mind to, you know, being successful at something once they come out. So that is neat. So
So with that said, my last question before I let you off here, what advice would you have for anybody leaving the military today?
Think twice before you exit. Make sure that you do want to exit that out of your idea as a career choice. If you're going to leave, make sure you get a technical trade or degree. That's about it. Try not to live in your past, the horrors of your past. I don't know, I'm a believer in Christ, so things that you did in the past, you know, Christ says he remembers them no more. You shouldn't either. Don't let it hold you down. Your failures or your things that haunt you. It's just like something a lot of people, you know, do. They live in regret, or they feel like they never made the right decision. Just move forward. So I don't know if it really makes sense, but
nope. You know, I'm picking up what you're putting down.
Yeah, because I see a lot of guys that when they leave, they're, you know, there's, I think you sponsor a lot of homeless veterans.
I do, yes.
Yes. So depression is an evil thing. So if, you know, if you're feeling down about something, you know, get help fast. But I always say look to Christ first, because he can, you know, pretty much solve all your answers, or he has all your answers to, you know, all your problems. And it's just trying to find that, you know, right person to, you know, help you get through that. It's just, I don't know if I'm creating too much of a long answer here, but enjoy your time you spent. Be proud of it. You know, if people say they don't, like the Jehovah's Witnesses, they won't talk to people who've been in the military. They turn their back on you. Don't worry about it. It's just no sweat on your shoulder. I do believe that you can't let people bother you, whether they recognize the flag or not. That's on them, not on you. It may anger you, It may anger what you fought for, what you believe in, or what you serve for, even if you haven't fought. Just live the life that Christ wanted you to, you know. So
that's good advice. Thank you.
Okay, sure.
Well, hey, I want to thank you again for coming on the show. I really appreciate it. You know, I'm just trying to collect a bunch of stories and all I want to do is help veterans, you know, and I think the best way for me to do that is to just talk to gentlemen like you and Frank and hear your stories and get your advice. So anybody listening to this, you know, they'll get something out of it. So I want to thank you.
Okay. I appreciate that very much. And I hope it didn't sound too corny during the interview. I've never been interviewed before, so it's
nope. just... You was perfectly fine. You did great. Okay,
so, if there's anybody interested out there that's watching this on Facebook, Johnson Atoll Health Issues, and, just let me know. There's three moderators on there. I'm one of them that allow people into the room. There's one guy that added me to it as a moderator. He is not sure how long he's going to be here, so he added me. And so if people get involved in that, and maybe we can add a couple more just in case, because we never know what's going to happen to the next guy. So
yep.
Get on there and we can go from there and kind of see what's going on and see how people are trying to help us get our issues heard in Congress and the Senate. So
I'll put a link to that in the notes for the show too, so people know how to get there.
Okay, sure. Appreciate that.
Okay. All right, sir. Well, you have an excellent weekend.
All right, you too. Thank you. God bless.
Bye. Okay.